The rhythm of the dripping water sped up, and now he heard what had been missing only moments before. The faint plink of the droplets hitting the trap. Sebastian snapped a towel from a small silver hook mounted on the wall and angrily wiped the liquid from his face. He looked into the mirror. A shape floated before him, a wrinkled face obscured by the smudged glass. He swiped the towel across the mirror to wipe the smudge away. There he was, his image clear. His eyes were tired, heavy bags hanging below them. Deep lines cut through his weathered skin. His hair looked thinner than he remembered. It had started to reveal empty patches of liver-spotted scalp.
When did I get so damn old?
It was a rhetorical question. The drip from the faucet turned to a stream as Sebastian gave the knob another twist. Water swirled around the bowl, washing away the thick brown spatters, gurgling as it was swallowed by the drain. The odd amplification remained, but was now accompanied by a more subtle sound, just under the splash. Sebastian listened. It was a familiar sound. In that moment, if he had allowed his imagination to run wild, he would have said it was the sound of voices whispering. 12. 3:45 p.m. Daniel slipped out the back door, making sure it did not slam behind him. The overcast day had burned off to reveal a blue sky just beneath, the way a skinned knee will reveal the redness of fresh flesh. Every few minutes the wind would pick up and blow from the north, pushing its way like a bully through the woods to the clearing, rocking the bushy bodies of trees gently to and fro. With one hand, Daniel powered up his cell phone, checking to make sure he had ample reception. 2 bars. Good enough. The display read home as the number automatically dialed. After 2 rings, a young girl answered. Hello? Claire? Who else would it be? His daughter replied with her perfect blend of childish playfulness and teenage smartass. Mom told me about your interview. I can't believe you're doing that. It's like a little crazy, you know? Yeah, I'm kind of surprised I'm here myself. So? See anything scary yet? Daniel smiled to himself. He always smiled when he talked to Claire. Not yet, sweetheart. But the day is young. He followed the trail of chipped, pale stones away from the house, closer to where the trees parted like a mouth yawning. Or screaming. You go to church yesterday? Yeah, with Mom. How was it? Intense. Heavy on the fire and brimstone. You know, 'cause of Halloween. Daniel knew. His church didn't actively discourage the holiday, but the lesson was always the same. Horror is the result of sin. Sin gives way to temptation. Temptation is the number one weapon of the devil. The formula was so simple. When you played it in reverse, you had a guaranteed best-selling book. Speaking of, you have any big Halloween plans? Claire gave a soft chuckle, obviously meant to go over her father's head. It didn't. Daniel knew what it meant. She assumed he still thought she was interested in trick-or-treating. He may be a lame, middle-aged, church-going dad, but he wasn't stupid. Claire had plans with her friends. Plans that would undoubtedly expose her to the temptations of underage drinking and premarital sex. But Daniel had a secret. A lame, middle-aged, church-going dad secret. He trusted his daughter. Jessica's sort of having a little get-together tonight, Claire said offhandedly. The understatement was a bit too obvious. A party? She was quick to protest. Not a party, just, you know, a few friends. A few friends. Age-old code for party. Nothing big. Probably just watch horror movies, that kind of thing. What's his name? A pause. The question had caught her off guard. Clint? Daniel gave a dramatic sigh. Oh, Clint. No, 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 Claire, not a boy named Clint. What's wrong with Clint?
Everything.
And Claire laughed. It was the same laugh she had as a child, 5 years old in a frilly pink dress her grandmother had given her, spinning circles until her giggling forced her down. It was the laugh that melted Daniel's heart. The laugh that, if it ever went away, would tear him to pieces. "I'll put Mom on," she said. "You do that," Daniel told her. "Have fun tonight," he groaned. "With Clint." Another laugh, then silence as Claire left her room and wandered down the hallway. Suddenly there was a burst of static, a shrill squelch in Daniel's ear. He jerked the phone from his ear just as a voice broke through it. "Hello? Hello? Sabrina? Daniel?" There was worry in his wife's voice. "How's it going?" He felt a warmth in his chest, the hidden flame that meant home. Daniel reached the last of the stones and stepped through the trees into the dense forest. He hadn't noticed it before, but the drone of cicadas now enveloped him, as if that one simple step had transported him to another world. "Daniel?" Her voice quivered, breaking the fluidity of her normally steady tone. "I'm here," he assured her. "I don't like this." The barren branches high overhead seemed to reach for one another, straining to clasp fingers bare of leafy flesh, pointed fingertips desperate to span the distance as the light wind knocked them gently about.
"Like what?"
"This. You. There. You should have just come home." "I'm here for the same reasons the others are here, baby. It's publicity. I've got the new book series coming out soon. This could help make sure it sells."
"Your books will sell. They always do."
"The Christian bookstores are saying they won't carry this one. It's the beginning of a backlash, Sabrina. They say my books glorify evil."
"That's ridiculous."
Daniel closed his eyes and took a deep breath. "I know that. You know that. This is the chance to explain myself. And if the church is going to abandon me, then I'll need the mainstream readers more than ever."
"No one's going to abandon you," she assured him.
For a long moment, neither of them spoke.
"I've heard about that house," Sabrina said finally. "I know the stories people tell."
"And that's just what they are, stories." A sigh, not so much for her as for him.
I don't like the idea of you flirting with the occult."
Daniel gave a sharp laugh. He knew he shouldn't go out of his way to show his irritation, but after 17 years of marriage, she should know him better.
"Sabrina, I'm here at a very ordinary, very unhaunted house to promote my books. Tomorrow I'll be on a plane and back in Chicago by dinner time."
"Do you promise? I mean that the house is only a house?"
Something creaked under Daniel's feet. He looked down to find that his shoes were completely obscured by fallen leaves. He scratched at the ground with his fraying leather shoe.
"Daniel? Is thing okay?"
The reception was cutting out. "It's the signal, sweetie. I'm going to lose you." His foot did not scrape dirt, but a harder substance. Cement, perhaps. But cement did not creak. He shoved the toe of his shoe down harder, and there came a sharp crack.
Wood.
It was wood. Daniel was fat. He knew he was fat. But in that moment he found himself to be amazingly agile, hopping into the air just as the wood plank snapped clean through beneath him. As he did, the phone slipped from his sweaty fingers. He landed a couple feet away, on the safety of solid ground, just in time to watch the phone drop straight down toward the split plank. One moment the cell phone was there, and the next it was swallowed by the jagged black slit in the cracked board. He heard the tinny, faraway voice of his wife call out,
"Daniel?"
And then the phone was gone.
"Shoot!" He lunged toward the crack in the board but stopped short, remembering that it was his weight that had snapped the plank in the first place.
God damn it!
He cried out. Immediately he looked around, his cheeks flushed with shame at taking the Lord's name in vain. Luckily, there was no one there to hear him. Over the tops of the trees, the Finch house silently watched. The wood that had snapped under his feet covered a well, the same well about which Wainwright had gone out of his way to warn them. Using his foot, Daniel brushed away the cover of brittle leaves and vines to reveal warped, weathered boards placed haphazardly over the well's stone mouth. Years of erosion from rain, snow, and ravenous termites had taken its toll on the boards. Great splintering cracks gouged deeply into the wooden flesh, the sides crumbling at the touch. The planks probably wouldn't have supported the lithe Kate, let alone the largest person in the group. The handyman Wainwright sent out to prepare the house must have missed this, or surely he would have replaced the boards. At the very least, he would have ringed the area in barrier tape. Daniel reached under the middle plank, and his bare fingers sunk slightly into the deteriorated wood. Thoughts of spiders filled his mind. Thin, needle-like legs scuttling in the dark. Fangs dripping with teardrops of golden venom. Sleek black bodies born of shadows. Webs in the nooks and crevices where only they could climb, like a trail of silken nightmares. Daniel could smell the dank odor of the well's mossy walls, of the stagnant water somewhere far below, of the absolute darkness. Glancing around, he located a stone, jagged like the tooth of some long extinct beast, and holding it directly above the slit of blackness, he dropped it down into the well. Its fall seemed impossibly long, the splash as it hit bottom far too faint. It can't be that deep, he thought. It was impossible. No well should go down that far, unless the digging of it exposed an immense chasm, a black pit long buried beneath the shifting earth. The ancient odor emanating from the well hit Daniel, as many lost scents do, with a misplaced memory from mental oblivion. When Daniel was just a boy, he and his family, his parents, his brother Peter, and his sister Mary Kay, lived in a ramshackle three-bedroom house 40 miles south of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It wasn't their first house, nor was it their favorite. His father had lost his job as a maintenance man for the city, and with an alarming shortage of jobs in the area, had no choice but to uproot his family and retreat to the only place that didn't demand a mortgage payment, his own father's hunting lodge. Daniel hated what Peter referred to as Grandpa's Whack Shack, a nickname Daniel knew was hilarious without entirely understanding its perverse meaning. The Whack Shack was small, drafty, and home to just about every type of insect in the Tar Heel State. Crickets, grasshoppers, cicadas, mosquitoes, hoverflies, deerflies, horseflies, silverfish, cockroaches, fire ants, carpenter ants, yellowjackets, honeybees, centipedes, millipedes, ticks. You name it, they had it. Crawling up the bathtub drain, burrowed under stacks of bath towels in the closet, nesting in the spaces where the sagging floors and warped ceilings had begun to separate from the dingy walls. The Whack Shack was never intended to house a family. It was Grandpa's escape from the city, where he and his hunting buddies would go for some peace and quiet, miles away from their nagging wives. Yet what Daniel despised most of all were the eight-legged monstrosities, the arachnids, the spiders. Daniel's father assured him there were only two kinds of spiders that could do any real damage. The brown recluse and the black widow. But to young Daniel, a sensitive teenager with every one of his childhood fears intact, spiders were the most horrifying creatures on the planet.
I read that at least once in their life, everybody will have a spider crawl into their mouth while they're sleeping,
Peter said to Daniel one day, knowing good and well what kind of damage this tidbit of information could do to his younger brother. The very thought of it. A spider with its prickly legs and deadly fangs creeping between his lips, welcomed in by the slow draw of his slumbering breath. It was enough to keep Daniel awake for nights on end. And then, one steamy summer afternoon, Daniel came face to face with the very thing he feared. It was Peter's friend, Kenny, who made him go in. A skinny, red-haired creep who lived next door being a mile and a half, as the crow flies. Kenny Milburn must have had a million freckles, and where there weren't freckles, there were pimples, so many that his face looked like a rotting apple, discolored and lumpy. That afternoon, after much begging and pleading, their mother ordered Peter to let Daniel tag along. It really wasn't much of a demand. Peter and Kenny had plans to go no farther than the front yard for a game of catch, but it annoyed Daniel's older brother and his no-good friend all the same. So when Kenny overthrew Daniel's prized official Mickey Mantle baseball, complete with faux signature, sending it racing into the crawl space under the house, it was Kenny who insisted Daniel go after it. Daniel looked from the darkened crawl space entrance to his older brother, not wanting to whine like a baby, hoping that Peter might see the fear in his eyes and offer to go himself. Instead, Peter stood silently as Kenny's taunts grew louder and louder. Before Daniel knew what was happening, he found himself down on all fours, inching his way across the line of shadow that marked an end to Sunlight's safety and the beginning of the underworld, the realm of the crawl space. It was damp underneath. The ground outside had been baked dry by the sun, but in the crawl space, the earth retained the wetness of recent rains. Daniel could feel it soaking through the knees of his blue jeans. He knew his mom would not be happy to find the soiled pants in the laundry hamper. The dank odor left by standing water filled his nose, the thick scent of mildew and mold. Daniel held his breath until little black spots would creep from the corners of his vision. Only then would he take in another quick, desperate gasp. His back scraped the underside of the house, and Daniel winced, sure that it would leave a blood-speckled spot in the middle of his shirt. He thought of his mom again, how she would totally flip out when she saw what he had done to his clothes. And then, there it was, a white orb glowing like a pearl in the damp belly of an oyster. Only a few more yards and the baseball would be in his hands. The black spots were not going away. Daniel took a deeper breath, tasting the years of sediment, the dirt and dust and decomposed leaves, but the black spots continued to close in. He was sure he would pass out. But strangely, he didn't feel the least bit lightheaded. One of the black spots spun down on a line of silk no thicker than a human hair, its body twisting to reveal the bright red hourglass on its belly, like the dab of blood Daniel was sure he had on his back. The black spots were not warnings of impending unconsciousness. They were alive. And they were everywhere. Terror swept through his round body in a million icy pinpricks. Daniel was sure, for an awful moment, that every deadly spider had decided to bite him at once. Without thinking, he reached out and snatched up the baseball, giving a helpless whimper as he tried to turn around. The crawl space was too tight. No matter how he twisted his body, he could not maneuver around to face the opening, that painfully distant square of light that meant the end to his hell. He began to panic. His eyes darted from the ground before him to the rough wood above, to the cement pillars supporting the house, stopping on a wisp of white just to the right of his shoulder. It was a peculiar substance, like cotton candy, but pale instead of pink. From its center, a black body scampered out, tested the air with its two front legs, and reared back like a startled horse. It seemed to sense that Daniel was close. So close. Reaching out as if it longed to touch the young boy's skin, to skitter across his rolls of flesh and under his clothes, where he wouldn't be able to brush it off. Where it could do what it lived to do. To bite. To kill. With a quick glance down to make sure the area was free of spiders, Daniel smacked his palms to the ground, the baseball still clutched in his right hand, and pushed off with all his strength, simultaneously lifting his knees and propelling himself straight backward. He knew he didn't have a chance of getting out without being bitten. He had never really thought he would see a Black Widow in the real world. Here was not one, but tens, perhaps hundreds of the monsters. His father's warning echoed in his mind. It would only take one bite. He felt a tickle on his bare skin. One of the spiders had fallen onto his arm and was skittering quickly higher. In another second, it would disappear into his sleeve. Daniel heard a horrible whimper escape his lips, and then he drew in a deep breath and puffed it out toward the spider. The spider was slipping its long black legs beneath his sleeve, and then the sharp breath whisked it away. But another Black Widow was on him in seconds, and another, and another. He was going to die in the crawl space. So, young Daniel Slatterson did the only thing he knew to do in situations like that one. He prayed. He prayed hard, eyes closed tightly, the words spilling from his quivering lips so quickly they became one solitary thing. God, if you get me out of this, I promise to live my life for you. The faster Daniel recited his prayer, the faster he pushed himself backward. His knee came down on the pointy edge of a stone, and Daniel winced, feeling the warm wetness of blood begin to saturate his muddy jeans, but still he did not stop praying. God, if you get me out of this, I promise to live my life for you. In his mind, he could picture his body swarming with the terrible arachnids. He could imagine their fiery bites, the poison hot as it coursed through his veins. His left palm and the baseball in his right hand dug ravines in the dirt, leaving odd, mismatched waves of earth in his wake. And then an amazing thing happened, the very last thing Daniel ever expected. Daylight warmed him. With one final thrust, he launched himself out of the crawl space and into the open air. A gust of wind blew the spiders free. He rolled across the grass, hoping to crush whatever deadly creatures remained beneath his thin cotton shirt. "What the hell's the matter with him?" Kenny asked dumbly. Daniel opened his eyes, squinting in the summer sun. Peter and Kenny were standing over him, black featureless shapes against the cloud-speckled sky. Black shapes. Springing up, Daniel tore off his shirt, his hands running quickly over his loose, pasty skin.
Are there any on me?
The hysteria made his voice quiver.
Any what?
Peter asked, confused. Kenny was bowled over laughing at the sight of Daniel's flab jiggling, barely finding enough air to power his horse-like guffaws.
Are there any on me?
Daniel asked again, shouting this time. Peter did a quick sweep of his brother's back, not sure what he was looking for, but thinking he would know it if he saw it. Finally, he shook his head. Nope. Nothing.
Nothing? Are you positive?
Nothing, Peter repeated.
Hey,
Kenny said to Daniel, his hoarse laugh calming to mild giggles. He cupped his hands as if he meant to catch something.
The ball, dummy!
Daniel looked down to his right hand, to where he still clutched Peter's prized baseball. Even in his blind panic, he hadn't dropped it. Peter was staring at his kid brother, his eyebrows furrowed, his head cocked.
What was under there, Danny?
Daniel didn't tell him right then. He waited until he had given himself a thorough inspection, standing with his back to the cracked bathroom mirror, peering over his shoulder for any indication of bite marks. There were none. Not a single mark. That evening, Daniel, Peter, Mary Kay, and their mother watched from across the yard as their father tossed a bug bomb into the crawl space, pulling the pin and chucking it like a grenade into a foxhole. As the noxious white fumes rolled out from under the house, giving it the appearance of a rickety square rocket readying for takeoff, Daniel became aware of two unimpeachable truths. Kenny Milburn was a grade-A asshole. And God was love. On the other side of the well, the path became more overgrown, but still there was an apparent route through the foliage. Daniel followed this, mindful of the thorny vines that tried to snag him as he went. Even in autumn, it was dark under the canopy of trees. The fat, brittle leaves of the oaks and elms above refused to let loose of their branches, reducing what sunlight there was to mere slivers. Ducking under a fallen branch, Daniel found himself at the edge of a slope. With his arms outstretched, grasping exposed roots for balance, he awkwardly maneuvered the steep terrain and was soon standing at the center of what appeared to be a dry creek bed. In one direction, the creek abruptly curved, cutting a path to the side of the house. Daniel assumed this led to the bridge they had crossed when they arrived earlier that afternoon. In the other direction, the ravine plowed straight through the countryside, a dusty trail that was once a stream. So this was Kill Creek, or what was left of it. With the exception of a few shallow puddles here and there, it appeared water had not flowed through this particular channel in years. Clumps of dead leaves formed curiously human-shaped mounds, giving the creek bed the appearance of an ancient burial ground. The only thing that seemed to thrive in the creek were vines, fat, knotted arms snaking through the forest floor, down the muddy slope, zigzagging over the creek bed in a patchwork of woven veins. Yet even the vines looked in desperate need of a drink. Although they were unusually large, about the size of a man's arm, their color was a sickly brown, their exterior covered in coarse, hair-like bristles. Daniel went to take a step and nearly stumbled, the toe of his shoe wedged beneath one of the thicker vines. That's odd. He didn't remember stepping over it to get to this particular spot, although he surely must have. Gone unnoticed, a vine this big would have tripped him. He tried to pull his shoe out from underneath it and discovered that a second vine, slightly smaller than the first, now ran directly behind his heel. How on earth did I manage to get my foot into this spot without knowing it? He wondered. He gave his leg a good yank, and his foot slid free, but his shoe remained in the tangle of vines. The unexpected smoothness of the sudden action caused Daniel to fall on his ass with a thud. As he did, he could have sworn he saw the vines constrict, tightening over his shoe like a snake attempting to keep hold of its prey. He sat there for a stunned moment, his eyes never leaving that shoe. The vines, of course, did not move. And after a full minute, he carefully reached between them and pulled the leather loafer out of their grasp. With a nervous chuckle, Daniel slipped the shoe on and turned back toward the slope, grasping a handful of yellowing weeds and preparing his poor arms for the climb. It was a good struggle, but he finally reached the top and was soon trudging down the trail. When he reached the well, he knelt down and secured the deteriorating planks back in place as best he could.
"I thought I told you to stay away from there."
The unexpected voice made Daniel cry out. He spun around. It was Wainwright, standing on the path leading back to the house.
"Oh, yeah, right,"
Daniel stammered, his heart pounding.
"I was just..."
Wainwright didn't let him finish the thought.
"Let's get back to the house. No reason to be out here."
Without another word, Wainwright turned and disappeared up the trail. Daniel followed. He pushed through the low branches of saplings and was once again behind the house. The sky had brightened since he left, and a large blanket of warm sunlight now lay over the house. Its brick glowed red. Its windows sparkled. The Finch house beckoned Daniel Slaughter to come home. 13. 4:14 p.m. Kate held her breath. She walked slowly down the second floor hallway, the camera perfectly level and centered. Wainwright always told her to invest in some form of Steadicam, but Kate prided herself on her camera work. She didn't need a cumbersome piece of equipment when she had two hands and the skill to pull off the shot. She was almost to the end of the hall, where a stained glass window was set into the wall of a small alcove, when the toe of her shoe scuffed the wooden floor. The camera in her hands bobbed slightly. See? He's right. You should have brought a Steadicam. She scolded herself. She stopped recording and pressed a button on the back of the camera's body to review the footage. Most of it was usable for B-roll. A nice tracking shot down the hall would come in handy for atmosphere when she cut together the longer version of their Kill Creek video. Moving into the alcove, she realized her right foot was butting up against the edge of a step. It was a staircase leading to the third floor. But at the top, instead of a door, there was a red brick wall. Rebecca Finch's bedroom. She had read about Rebecca's room in the Adderdale book. The few times Wainwright spoke of the brick wall, it was with an odd reverence, his voice low as if someone might hear him. He had purposely left it off his tour of the house. He wanted the authors to discover it for themselves. He wanted the house to draw them to it. The colored light from the stained glass window spilled across the surface of the first step, but it went no farther. Shadows engulfed the rest. Kate quickly adjusted the f-stop and shutter speed. She twisted the LCD screen so that she had a good view of the shot. She angled the lens at the multicolored light at the floor in front of the first step and pressed the button to start recording. She took a breath and held it. On the screen, the image was exposed perfectly. The richness of the sunlight gave way to the black depth of shadow as she smoothly tilted the camera up. One by one, the stairs led higher. Carefully, Kate began to zoom out to reveal the brick wall at the top. The wall was gone. "Holy shit!" she said, blowing out the breath she had been holding. She stumbled backward. The shot was ruined, but she didn't care. She had seen... What the hell did I see? She looked up to the top of the stairs, everything in her being telling her not to. Leave. Run. You don't want to see it again. The brick wall was there, as it had been, as it should be. Her thumb, now slick with sweat, found the button to review the footage and pressed it. On the LCD screen, she watched as the shot made its way gracefully up the steps, up to the brick wall covering the bedroom door. The wall hadn't disappeared. So why did she think she saw... a woman, Kate realized, the image forming once again in her mind. The wall wasn't there, but there was a woman with black hair, and she was... Kate closed her eyes tight, trying to force her mind to make sense of the memory. She was scratching the air, Kate said aloud. Of that she was sure. The woman had been scratching the open air, her fingers curled into claws, fingernails digging into the space before her as if the wall were still there. Kate shuddered. She was trapped, and she wanted out. Like the rest of the house, the living room had the feeling of a museum whose restrictive red ropes had been removed to allow Sam to wander freely. It's the silence, he thought. That was partly it. The quiet within the house did encourage a sense of reverence, but it was also the amazing craftsmanship on display in each room. To think that one man was responsible for not only the structure, but also its countless intricate details was mind-boggling. The stonework around the fireplace, the images of leaves and vines carved into the crown molding, even the grain on the wood floors seemed to run and swirl in deliberate patterns. Sam moved farther into the room and found himself staring out of the large window that looked out onto the front yard. Outside, a light breeze softly tossed the tall grass to and fro. The gravel drive cut through the yard and over the wooden bridge to disappear into a wall of trees. Above the trees, a bit of the gray had burned off to reveal patches of blue sky beneath. A woman stood just outside the window. Sam gasped. The woman had appeared out of nowhere and was now at the porch railing, looking out into the yard. Black clothes clung tightly to her lithe body and a single rope of hair snaked down her back. More, he realized, immediately feeling foolish. Sam passed beneath a grand archway and into the foyer. There was the elevator on his left. Its accordion gate was closed. Thick shadows hung low in the corners of the cab. Beyond the elevator were stairs that led to the second floor. He reached the front door and opened it, stepping out onto the porch. There was no one there. Sam pulled the door shut behind him. He looked around, listening. Only the faint whistling of the breeze and the rustling of tall grass. He called out, "More?" No response.
"Careful," he warned himself. "It could be Wainwright messing with you. He's setting you up for a scare to make a fool of you for the camera. Or worse, maybe he has something darker planned for us."
Sam shook off the thought. The weathered boards creaked under his feet as he crossed to the exact spot where he had seen her standing. He put his hands on the rail, just as she had. He stared out into the yard. Before him was the twisted claw of the beech tree. The breeze appeared to have no effect on it. Its branches were motionless, its few leaves frozen in place. "They hung her from one of those branches," a voice called out from nearby. Moore was leaning against the side of the house around the next section of the wraparound porch. Her head was cocked back at a sharp angle so that Sam had no choice but to stare into her ruptured pupil. Goodman's lady. They dragged her dead body out here and strung it up. And for what?
They were Confederate raiders, Sam said.
They were pieces of shit.
Now you're just being redundant.
Moore stared at him for a silent beat, then pushed off from the wall and crept slowly across the porch to stand by his side. She looked out at the tree. The breeze picked up, and still its branches did not move. "I hope, when they died, that they saw her bloated face staring down at them from that tree, and knew she was waiting for them on the other side." She paused, relishing the thought. Then the mean little smile playing at her lips slowly vanished.
"She doesn't believe that could happen," he realized. "She knows there was no justice here."
Sam listened to the wind whispering between them. Moore seemed lost in heavy thoughts.
"I've read your books," Sam said in an attempt to lighten the mood.
"Oh, yeah?"
"They're messed up in the best possible way."
Moore laughed, an honest, out-before-she-could-catch-it laugh. She relaxed, just a little bit.
"I've read you two," she said.
"Oh, man, here it comes."
"And?"
"And you hold back."
She turned to face him. She studied him with her mismatched eyes. "Like you're being cautious. Like you're hiding something." A wisp of smoke slipped up into Sam's throat and twisted, trying to take hold.
"And you," he managed to say. "You write like you're going to battle. So what is it, Moore? What are you fighting?"
She leaned back against the railing and considered the question.
"The same thing you're running from, I suppose.
Life is fight or flight. I choose to fight." Her gaze drifted down to Sam's scarred left arm. She said nothing. Without the usual cover of her sunglasses, Sam had a perfect view of Moore's ruptured pupil. He knew that in most cases a ruptured pupil was the result of physical trauma. When he had first seen her eye, he'd found it revolting. He wasn't proud of that fact, but it was true. Now he had a different reaction. That eye was a constant reminder of some past pain.
"We both have our secrets," he thought.
Her eyes flicked up and narrowed as she smiled. She knew he was watching her. And she liked it.
"So, what do you think of Wainwright?" she asked.
"Careful. Don't sound crazy."
"But you are crazy," his mind insisted. I don't trust him, was all Sam offered. And the house? Sam considered this for a moment. Nothing yet has made me believe that any of the stories are true. How would you write it, if you decided to write its story? Now it was Sam's turn to smile.
Oh, I don't know.
I do, she said confidently. She pushed off from the railing and began to slowly circle around Sam as she talked, forcing him to turn to follow her. You would start with a character from some seemingly perfect small town, someone not unlike yourself. You know, a little bland. Sam gave a snort.
Sounds good so far.
And the house wouldn't be in the country. It would be right in the middle of town, so you could overpopulate the book with too many characters and Midwestern details. No offense.
She stopped, her back now to the house. She folded her arms across her chest and cocked her head in an over-exaggeration of serious thought.
There would be a boy, some painfully sweet little kid, who is obsessed with the house. Maybe he saw something there when he was riding by on his paper route. By the way, kids still have paper routes in your book. Something he can't explain, but no one will believe him. And then the house would begin to infect the people of the town with its evil. Their unhealthy urges and dark fantasies, which up until this point have only existed in their heads, drive them to commit unspeakable acts. The evil in the house pulls every loose thread in that small town until the entire community unravels, and in the end, that little boy is the only one who can stop it. She squinted and glanced up, sorting out one last detail. And the kid would probably have some sort of half-assed psychic power or some shit.
Moore looked to Sam. She grinned seductively.
So, how'd I do?
She nailed you, he told himself.
Sam pretended to feel the pockets of his jeans for some misplaced object.
I wish I'd brought a pen or something.
Would you mind emailing all that to me? It's fucking fantastic.
Moore laughed, her armor down for the moment.
What about me?
Sam cocked his head.
I'm sorry? How would I write about this house?
Let's see.
He ran a hand over the back of his stubbly head.
First of all, the house would be in a city.
Okay.
Some run-down, disgusting part of town where people do combinations of drugs that make almost no sense and engage in sexual activity that in no way sounds enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Moore's jaw had clenched slightly.
Shoes on the other foot. Guess that's not easy for her.
There would be a handful of thoroughly unlikable characters, just filthy, filthy people.
Except for one.
A young woman from somewhere else. An affluent family, perhaps. Or a woman who married young and now feels trapped in her painfully domestic life.
Who is she? Moore asked. She took a step closer.
She's a police officer. No, wait. She works for a security company. She's the only woman on the payroll, which means she's surrounded by blowhard, overweight men with fake badges and tasers on their belts. The company has been contracted by a real estate firm to keep crackheads and tweakers from squatting in empty houses, and that's where she falls in with the other characters, when she tries to run them out of a house that looks suspiciously similar to this one.
He pointed up at the porch overhang and the unseen stories above it.
Together, they discover that a power in the house offers them the escape they've always desired. But, of course, it comes at a price.
Of course, Moore said quietly.
She had taken another step toward him without Sam noticing. She was no more than 4 feet away from him now. Her eyes never left his as he spun his yarn.
Her eyes are actually very beautiful. Not despite the flawed pupil. Because of it.
He continued.
Some entity,
older than time, lacking in anything resembling human emotion, is using our heroes as a means to gain access to our world. And it's working. They're becoming addicted to the power, which gives them a high that can't be matched by drugs or sex. Moore furrowed her brow and stared at Sam. That misshapen pupil seemed to dilate even as the pupil of her other eye stayed the same. So far, I'm not getting what's so bad about their bargain. Sounds like a good time to me.
Well, that depends on your definition of a good time. See, the entity requires sacrifice. First, it's sexual sacrifice. You'll be happy to know there's a lot of spilled seed and an unnatural amount of fluids.
Perfect. She's so close. When did she get so close?
But then, the sacrifice becomes emotional, as they pull their lives apart, destroying the happiness of anyone close to them. And finally, there is physical sacrifice, each member of the group offering themselves up to be brutally murdered, until the only two left are our girl and the dirtbag she's screwing, whose name is probably something bizarrely antisocial like Thrash or Bobby Filth.
That's pretty bad.
Sam put his hands in the air. Hey, you're the one who wrote it.
Moore leaned in.
I guess we really have each other pegged, don't we?
The breeze picked up, sweeping across the porch and twisting around them, but Moore's hair did not move. The braid draping down her back remained still. There was a dangerous smile playing at the corners of her mouth. Her right pupil was a bottomless pit, inviting Sam to fall in.
You can't trust her, he told himself.
But Sam wasn't sure this was true. He wanted to trust her. He wanted to trust someone. And there was something about her that just felt real. The sound of the front door opening broke the spell. Behind Moore, Daniel lumbered out. The porch boards groaned under his weight.
There you two are, he said.
Moore pulled her lips tightly against her teeth.
Daniel Slaughter.
Exactly who I wanted to see.
Seriously? Without another word, Moore marched past him and disappeared into the house.
Oh, I get it, Daniel said to Sam.
She was just being awful, as usual.
She's testing you.
And I feel like I keep failing.
Daniel suddenly snapped his fingers, remembering something.
Oh, if you go out back, be careful. The cover on the well is not at all sturdy. I almost fell into it.
Lost my phone in the darn thing.
The rustling of leaves got Sam's attention. The branches of the beech tree were swaying, the leaves rippling from end to end. Yet this time, there was no breeze.
Moore slipped through the shadows. She heard faint voices that were growing louder the closer she crept. She loved being in the darkness, feeling its cold embrace as she moved up the stairs, unseen. She stopped at the top and peered around the corner. Kate and Wainwright stood in a cramped alcove just off the main hall of the second floor. To their left was a stained glass window through which the day's last bit of daylight streamed in, the gloom transformed by the window's multicolored panes. Against the light, they were silhouettes. They were still too far away and their voices too low to make out exactly what they were saying, but Moore could tell by the way Wainwright was holding Kate by the shoulders that there was something wrong with the girl. He bent down to look her in the eyes, but she glanced away.
What was it? His silhouette was asking excitedly. What did you see?
She shook her head, unable to put it into words. Wainwright pulled her closer, encouraging her to slip her hands around his waist. He whispered something to her. Moore strained to hear what they were saying.
Try to remember,
Moore overheard him tell her.
It was right there.
She motioned to someplace behind Wainwright, farther into the alcove.
I think. Hell, I don't know. Maybe it was just a trick of the light.
Moore rolled her eyes. Kate sounded like a goddamn bumpkin with that southern twang. How could Wainwright take anything she said seriously? Wainwright looked to where Kate was pointing.
What did it look like?
It... Her voice trailed off as she tried to conjure up an image in her head. Forget it. I'm sorry.
But you saw something, right?
It was less a question than a statement of fact. Maybe. He pondered this, his foot tapping the wood floor. Then he nodded.
Okay. Okay. Let's keep this between us. Don't tell the others.
Moore frowned. She heard Sam's voice telling her, I don't trust him. Kate gave a small, earnest laugh. My dad would lose it if he knew his sweet little preacher's daughter was spending the night in a place like this.
Yeah, well, your dad would be even more upset if he knew you were sleeping with your boss.
Not because you're my boss, Kate said teasingly. Because you're white.
Right. Not much I can do about that, then, is there?
Kate smiled. Wainwright ran a hand up her cheek to the nape of her neck and kissed her. Kate dug her fingers into his thick hair and kissed him harder. Something about this intimate moment troubled Moore. That girl would let him talk her into anything, she thought. She watched as the two silhouettes merged into one big, oddly shaped shadow. They finally parted and stepped away from the window. Moore could make out their features once again. Wainwright took Kate's hand in his, and together they disappeared into their bedroom. Time to find out what they're hiding. Moore left her hiding place and moved silently down to the alcove where Wainwright and Kate had been standing. She looked to where Kate had pointed. What the hell? She whispered. Why would someone build a brick wall at the top of a staircase? 14. 6:25 p.m. There's another hallway. How the hell did we miss that? Sam wondered. In the kitchen, when facing the sunroom and back doors, there was a narrow hall to the right that led to the foyer and ultimately to the living room. Had one of them bothered to look to the left, however, they would have noticed a second hall, not quite as narrow as the first, but much darker, for it lacked any windows. This hall had not been on their initial tour, either forgotten or purposely avoided. Now Wainwright motioned to the dark hallway, telling the group,
"We'll eat in the dining room."
On the kitchen island, Wainwright and Kate had arranged a modest spread of food. Beside the numerous takeout containers was a stack of plastic plates and an assortment of plastic utensils. The mood was surprisingly light as the group filled their plates, piling on heaps of Midwestern picnic fare. Chicken, turkey, roast beef, sides of green beans, baked beans, corn, pasta salad, and potato salad. Sebastian hovered over a plate of cheeses and fruit. Moore went for the rarest of roast beef. Sam made a simple turkey and Swiss sandwich. And Daniel sampled more than a bit of everything. Their drinks were equally appropriate. Sebastian had a glass of Bordeaux, Sam a bottle of beer from the fridge, Moore poured herself a whiskey, neat, and Daniel opted for the more conservative choice of iced tea. Wainwright and Kate prepared their plates and poured their drinks last, allowing the four writers to wander down the hallway as a group. As he left the kitchen, Sam noticed the dog-eared paperback of Phantoms of the Prairie sitting on the counter near the island. Wainwright's copy, he realized. It hadn't been out of the young man's hands since they arrived, and now there it was, forgotten on the counter. Sam made a mental note of this and followed the others. It was astonishing that the dining room could have existed in the house without them knowing. It was a massive space, easily the biggest in the house. Large windows lined one wall, allowing both the fading evening light into the cavernous room and a beautiful view of the backwoods. At the center of the room was a long wooden table covered in a red tablecloth. Red leather was stretched over the backs and seats of each chair and secured with rustic nail heads. There were 10 chairs, four on each side, and a single chair at the heads of the table. A two-tiered chandelier was suspended over the table. Three candelabras were lit and evenly spaced. Opposite the windows, more candles flickered in a small fireplace. As was customary when writers gathered, they began by complaining about their publishers.
"They want me to join Twitter," Sebastian announced from the head of the table, laughing. "I told them that I still had a rotary telephone and wrote on a typewriter."
"Christ, you're old," Moore said. Sebastian sighed.
"Oh, there was something wonderfully simple yet elegant about the old way. The first chapter of your book published in the New Yorker or Playboy. Full-page ads in the country's largest newspapers. A few well-publicized in-store events at the Strand or City Lights. Your books sold on the strength of your writing, not your number of online followers."
Moore washed the roast beef down with a sip of whiskey. "Hate to say it, fellas, but you're all spoiled. You've had publishers and agents and managers and publicists for way too long. 7 years ago, I was editing my first book, Biter, begging any friend I could to read it, paying for cover design out of my own pocket, and then putting the damn thing out myself. There were no well-publicized in-store events or first chapters in jerk mags for T.C. Moore. It was all word of mouth, and I had to have the biggest mouth of all."
"Somehow, I doubt that was a problem for you,"
Sebastian said with an ornery smile.
"Screw you, old man," Moore replied with a grin.
Sam glanced around the room. They were shy, two people.
"Where are Wainwright and Kate?" he wondered. "Why would Wainwright miss the opportunity to get this all on camera?"
"I made Biter a massive hit all by myself, and I pulled in 70% of the net profits," Moore continued. "Publishers got down on their hands and knees begging to take Biter off self-publishing so they could put it in every bookstore in the world. So I made a deal. And what was the first thing I got? A new watered-down cover that would appeal to the one-piece bathing suit crowd. What's the next thing I got? My profits cut to a pathetic 20%.
Daniel's chair groaned as he leaned back.
"But you don't have to hustle anymore. You're a household name. Your books are bestsellers. You've sold the movie rights."
"I sold out. That's what I did.
To reach a larger audience, to make sure your work lives on as long as possible."
"Amen to that," Sebastian said, lifting his wine glass.
Sam crossed his arms. Wainwright's absence was making him nervous. He glanced around at the others.
"They don't even notice. They don't seem to care.
So why do you?" he asked himself.
"Because I don't know why he brought us here. He brought us here because he admires us."
His right hand slid down to feel the haphazard ridges of his scars.
"How can anyone admire me?"
Moore took another bite of roast beef, still considering Daniel's last comment. "My work is popular because it pushes boundaries. That's what my readers expect. But the marketing of my books is shit. My books are loud, but the marketing isn't, because my books have gone corporate. So yes, I have a team behind me now that allows me to write from a killer house in the Hollywood Hills while they take care of the rest. But what's the point? I'm willing to go to the darkest, nastiest places in my psyche in order to top my last book, and my publisher's what? Praying to White Jesus for a starred review in Publishers Weekly?"
"You want your marketing to be as extreme as your books?" Daniel asked.
He looked completely befuddled by Moore's point of view.
"Yes!" Moore cried out. "Fuck yes! Nero burned down Rome just so he could rebuild it the way he wanted it. Yes, if I'm going to sweat blood to write a book, I want my publisher to bleed in marketing the damn thing."
"I wish marketing was my biggest worry." Daniel was holding a rolled-up piece of prosciutto between two fingers.
"At least you all still have people who want to publish you."
"What the hell are you crying about, Slaughter? You have like a billion books on the shelf," Moore said. Daniel sighed like he suddenly regretted speaking up. But it was too late now. The other writers were staring at him, waiting. "I think my publisher's going to dump me soon," he said. The comment pulled Sam out of his own thoughts.